because he came in with the energy trapped in a certain model. He had this fantastic amount of energy, but it was all trapped in a certain kind of a model, which kept him in his like karmic place, which I'm sure he will go back into another 100,000 times before he's able to finish with it. But all I did was I kept converting that energy into another form of energy, into the place of, right, yeah, well, here we all are. Well, it's all love. Well, right, aren't you here? I'm here. Wow, dig this scene. Can you imagine that? You've come a long way for 15, you know. Must have been high from last time. I'm just putting it into another context, and then the context is, it's all happening right. Wow, watch the drama unfold. Look at that karma. Boy, that's heavy karma. That's from another position. It's from another vantage point on the psychodynamic sense. It's from looking at it from this place instead of from this place. But the thing is that the place I'm looking at it from is much more of a unitive place. It's much more of a one place. So by 10 minutes, he realizes that he and I are one person. And where he is in time, space is merely the manifestation of that particular part of our drama. So he comes in all isolated, stuck in his drama, and he immediately gets into that unitive experience where we're sharing. In other words, by taking on his karma, I, in a sense, offer, say, okay, fella, let's hook up and we'll share energy. Now, sometimes you do that and a person's amazingly stubborn. I mean, they stick in their thing. They're very heavy, you know. And you open up and the jaw juts forward. Well, it's all true what you say, but. That but is always the one. That but. They just butt against it. Yeah, but. It's always but. Here we are. Because I have so much. It's beyond faith. It's just a complete certainty that there are certain forms of energy or frequencies of vibration that are groovier than others and that everybody wants to be there. So this is what is, in a sense, meant by taking on somebody's karma. And you can only take on somebody's karma when you can pass it through. There are a lot of very well-meaning, kind, good people who sit and listen to somebody else's problem, and they take them all on themselves. That's what I used to do as a therapist. And at the end of the day, I'd go home, and I'd fall into the bathtub, and I'd be so like, oh, God, one more patient, and I'm going to, you know. Everybody would come and hand me their thing, and I'd put it on my back because I had big, broad shoulders, and I could handle it, you know. And I'd go under. I mean, there's only so much, you know, that stuff you can carry. Because I had nothing to do with it either but take it on at the level they were taking it on. Because in psychotherapy, in psychodynamic terms, from a psychological point of view, all I had to offer was the substitution of one model at that same level of energy for another model at that same level of energy. Because to me, personality was as important as it was to them. And now, personality, wow, look at that, man. Look at personality. Imagine that. I mean, you think you're somebody. You really think you're somebody who's suffering. Boy, that's a heavy one. I don't think I'm anybody. I'm not interested. Somebody says, aren't you interested in my problem? I say, I'm not even interested in my own. Why should I be interested in yours? Personality is not the variable. It's not the dimension on which I chop it all up anymore. Because at this other frequency, personality is more stuff. More stuff. Now we're starting to get to this, we're starting to explore the feelings connected with what is this business of energy exchange. Now, for example, when I look into somebody's eyes, when most people look into other people's eyes, they are going through a little social drama. And they are saying, like, something to the effect of, here I am, or who are you, or I love you, or isn't this deep, or some such structure they're imposing on the experience. Because But they forget that the eyes are the window of the soul, not of the personality. The eyes are much deeper than all that. And at the level where your eyes really are and my eyes really are, there just is isness. There isn't any interpersonal thing at all. And what happens when I look into somebody's eyes is I'm just exactly as if I lit this candle and looked at the candle. It's exactly the same thing. It's just flame. It's light. And I'm just looking into light. What's interpersonal? It's not interpersonal. I'm just looking into light. Now, around that light is the face, and the face is doing its interpersonal thing. Like all these different facial expressions. Like, I'm friendly, you know. I won't show my teeth, my incisors. I don't bite. I won't eat you alive. I'm kindly. I've told this before. I used to, one night, I was in New York in an apartment, and I had taken some LSD in preparation for doing a television show. David Susskind show. And I had some time before I had to go there, and there was a party at a friend's house, and I was over there on up in the Upper East Side. And there was this chick there who was sketching people's faces on the wall, and she had Allen Ginsberg and Tim and Bill Burrows and, you know, a lot of those people. And I came in, and they decided that although I didn't really qualify as an important enough person, there was nobody else around to draw, and she was there for the evening, so she would draw me. So would I pose? Sure, I'd pose. So I stood up to pose. And I thought, well, who am I? I mean, who is she sketching? So I thought, well, I'm really a young man looking into the future. So I became a young man looking at the future. So she sketched away, and she was happy, and she was giving me this little talk of, you have nice, you know, eyes, and the whole routine. And about halfway through it, my mind was going so fast, I thought, well, you know, I'm kind of tired of being a young man looking into the future. And I won't move, but I think what I'll be now is her lover. So I didn't do anything. I just thought of being her lover. And I just thought of it, and I stood there. I didn't change anything as far as I knew, and she started to erase and erase and erase and started sketching another face. And after a while, I was sort of tired of that one, too, and I thought, well, I'll be a wise old man. And I didn't change. Nothing happened. I didn't say, well, now I'll be, you know, it was nothing gross. Nothing where she'd say, you've moved. She didn't ever say to me I had done anything wrong, see. But then she erased it all again, and finally, she says, I can't do your face for some reason. It's just like liquid. I can't seem to... Because mind and matter are so intimately related. Mind and matter are so intimately related. That your face is always a manifestation of your desires or your thoughts or who you think you are or how you think it is. And your social role. And you see why the little drama I've carried out with many of you already, is to look into your eyes at a certain place where we establish that higher frequency contact, and then the face, which is the sort of frame around those eyes, is a role. And we both see the role. From this other place, we see the role you're in and the role I'm in. And the minute we acknowledge it collaboratively, then it changes. Because then immediately you are freed from attachment to that role, and then there's a new role. See? And then you look at that one, you say, wow, yeah, and that one too. And then there's a new one. And then there's a new one. Because in fact, every being is everything. That's the way it works. Every human being is mother, father, child, lover, wise man, skeleton. And I've And I learned this lesson from Ronnie Lang, from the English psychiatrist. Because I went to England and I visited with him, and in 5 minutes he said, I think we ought to take LSD together. And we went to a place and we took LSD a few days later. And the minute we took LSD, he took off his clothes except for shorts. He started to do yoga. And this was about 5 years ago, and 4 years ago, and it really shook me up. I didn't know what was going on. I mean, that wasn't my idea of a session. My idea of a session, you put on a Miles Davis record, and you get comfortable on a mattress, and you go on mind trips. And then after a while, we looked at each other, and that look lasted about 6 hours. And in the course of the entire trip we went through social role interaction after social role interaction. So what we would do is, and this was all done, there was never a word spoken in the whole 5 or 6 hours. He would become a child, and I would see this childlike face. And it would arouse in me all of my nurturant qualities. And so I would become like a very nurturant, protective being. And then we both stay in that thing until we both had completely absorbed and accepted that role identity, understood who we were. And then, very slowly, at first he did it, he led me, he showed me how to do it. His face would change. He'd start to think of himself now as the nurturant being, and he'd become this nurturant being, and I would see like the eternal mother and father and protector there, and I would become the little child who needed all that. And then we'd reverse roles, you see, and we'd live out those until we could accept those totally, what it meant to be the child, what it meant to be the parent. And we went through judge and criminal and teacher and student and lovers and playmates and enemies, and that was scary. I mean, it's scary with that level of intensity that we were to go through enemies, to hate somebody. And feel, you can keep the contact of the eyes and still feel that intense hate, of real hate, and get into the social role of hating somebody. And that scared me for a long time. I wasn't sure I could handle that one. That was so powerful. It took me a long time to be able to hate him that much. And what he was teaching me was, and this too, yes, and this one too, yes, and this one too, that before you can get on with it, you have to accept every single part of the complex mosaic that makes you a social human being, which is all of these particular outfits you can wear. Because you watch a little girl, and she's being taken care of by her mother, and then along, and she sees a little pussycat, or turns to her doll, or finds a sick bird, and she's suddenly the mother, and she's so maternal and so nurturing. And then the bird gets better and flies to its nest, and it starts to nurture its bird. And you get a, you feel the roles within roles within roles that everybody has. And you've got to accept all of those ones because of greed and anger and avarice and laziness and lust and all of your sexual manifestations at every level. You've got to accept all those too, because you are everything. Everybody is the eternal mother. Everybody's the eternal mother. Most male is the eternal mother. And every woman has in her that male, rational, directive search of the Holy Grail element too. And so the face keeps changing, but the eyes are that totally impersonal place. The eyes are the higher frequency contact. And you can really think of it as stratas of frequency. And you can think of the face and the whole social realm. And it's as if your clothing and your whole cultural social come on is one frequency. And then your face and your personality and so on is like another frequency. And your emotions at the pure state are still another frequency. And then your ideas are still another frequency. And then behind your ideas are an even higher frequency, which where form has started to all become one. So that how quickly your own thought process is extricated from attachment to any specific definition of self or other, any subject-object kind of labeling, the quicker you get out of your rational, structural sequential, linear type thought process. The faster you start to get into a relationship to the forces around you where there is an energy exchange, And most of you feel tired because you spend all your time boxed up in a model of who you are and how it is and how it works. And that's what gets tired, the model. It gets fatigued because that model has a tiny little carburetor and it can only handle a very, very little amount of input. Very, very little amount of input. I'm tired. Who's tired? I'm tired. Who's that? He's tired. Oh. Who are you? I'm watching him be tired. Tiredness is. Now, we've concentrated thus far on the input of the energy, the input end of the energy system. Now, if we think a moment about the output, then we start to understand, because these are, of course, one and the same, finally, since there is no giving and there is no receiving. There is only isness. Like taking out of one pocket and giving it to the other. I mean, how meaningless. If you and I are one, who's going to give what to who? To whom? When a person is closest to their ancestry within the physical evolutionary system, that means they are closest to their animal nature, then their primary concern is survival. And they don't have lower species on the phylogenetic scale are not terribly involved in seeking pleasure. They are much more involved in just living out instinctive processes, and they have fear of loss of integrity as a time-space being. They are not terribly self-conscious. The dog isn't going around saying, well, I'm a dog this trip, and that's the way it is in this incarnation. And you say, well, the dog is, it's mindless action. How very high of the dog. The But the problem is that the dog, you have to go through self-consciousness before you can become mindless at the other end. And the dog is still totally attached to its time-space locus. Totally attached. And the relation with a cat gets very eerie because of the peculiar qualities of a cat, that the cat's consciousness, a cat is almost pure consciousness with very little intellect. It's just a pure sensitizing response mechanism. It's like, it doesn't live in time that much. A cat lives in the eternal present a great deal. Cats are very high, the temple cats are symbolically chosen for that reason, because they have very high statements in a way. And yet they are completely stuck in that particular time-space locus. Well, now, when you are at that particular level, then all of your energy is directed towards survival. And the fulfillment of instinct arousal. So you will copulate. You won't copulate in order to A, have fun, or B, have children, but in the course of it there will be children there will be more of the species, because this process is merely running out because it's built into the system. As anybody knows that's ever had a dog or a cat in heat, and for miles around the friends come and cry and yell outside the door. Although you didn't send out calling cards and the dog didn't, spruce up for the occasion. The whole thing just runs off. The whole process runs off. Now, in the Indian system of what are called chakras are spiritual centers. They're pranic centers. They're centers of this life force we've been talking about. That if the life force is localized in the body, it gets localized at different places in the body's system, anywhere along the body at different points. And if one is primarily survival-oriented, it is located in the first chakra. First chakra. And this is down at the base of the spine, down in that area. Down by the Cossacks. And if you are a primarily first chakra person, if that's where your energy is all located, then everything you eat, everything you take in, is used for those purposes connected with that energy output. It all comes from that place. And so it's for running, and it's for attacking, and it's for anger, and it's for defense, and it's for instinct living out. That's what first chakra action is all about. And then the next place you get to on this tour, going up this river of through the spine, is the second chakra, which is primarily the sexual chakra. And here your major concern is with sexual gratification. This is no longer instinct running off. This is now lust. It's desire. It's a psychological process of sexuality. It's what Freud was a second chakra. Freud was an analyst of the second chakra. He was in the second chakra, and therefore he saw the second chakra. And he wrote about it more exquisitely than anybody else wrote about it. And Adler, who got into things like superiority and inferiority and so on, he was concerned primarily with the third chakra, because the third chakra is the ego. Is ego. It's the development of the rudimentary sense of self. It's self-consciousness. And it's like, what's in it for me? What's in it for me? You're no longer doing it at the animal level of security, but you're doing it just for ego enhancement. Ego enhancement. And when you look at big business, for example, and you see that the whole game is like a huge percentage of the relations of the interpersonal relations of the executives are all at the third chakra level. They are all ego enhancement. Look what I can do. Look at me flex my muscles. I can scare you with this bank loan, or I'll move this, or I'll do that, or this is how much. I remember meeting a guy at the, when my father used to be in the railroad, meeting a guy from the, some guy from a bank in New York. And the first thing he wanted to tell me was that he had, could sign for $12 million at will. Anytime he wanted to give away $12 million in the bank, he just had to sign his name. Of course, it's absurd because he's got no degrees of freedom, or like he's got such a tiny degree of freedom. He just makes one mistake and he doesn't sign his name again for years, you know. Except, I'm sure, on the parole register. And that's the only reason he was given that right to sign the name, because they knew he would play the game a certain way. But that's an ego trip. I mean, can you imagine a man getting gratification just out of being able to sign a thing that allows $12 million to transfer? That's just straight power. That's power, and power is third chakra. Power is third chakra. And most of what this society is concerned with is second and third chakra activity. Playboy is second chakra, fortune is third chakra, time is third chakra. Life is in between second and third.